Have you ever seen a seemingly perfect pane of tempered glass just suddenly shatter into a million tiny mosaic pieces for no obvious reason? I mean, nobody touched it, no wind blew, it just exploded. Or maybe you've wondered why a thick metal pipe that's been sitting still for decades suddenly warps the exact moment a plumber cuts into it.
Yeah, it's honestly an incredibly eerie phenomenon when you first see it, because you're looking at an object that appears completely at rest, right? It just seems totally at peace with its environment, completely static.
But it's a total lie. And, well, that brings us to the mission of today's deep dive. We are exploring the invisible trapped forces living inside everyday objects, forces that remain inside a body even when it's completely stationary.
Exactly. And we're pulling our intel today from two really expensive landmark academic papers by P.J. Withers and H.K.D.H. Badesia. Both are simply titled Residual Stress.
Okay, let's unpack this, because my first thought is that a hidden stress just waiting to, you know, warp a pipe or shatter a window is inherently a bad thing. It sounds like a catastrophic manufacturing defect waiting to happen.
Well, I can see why you'd assume that, but it's actually a double-edged sword. If these residual stresses are left unchecked, or they happen accidentally, yeah, they absolutely cause unexpected failures. They drastically shorten an object's lifespan.
Right, because they just add on to the normal stress the object already faces.
Exactly. But engineers also deliberately weaponize these stresses. We intentionally trap these colossal forces inside materials to make them virtually indestructible.
I promise you, by the end of this deep dive, you are going to look at everything around you completely differently. From the smartphone in your pocket to the massive steel beams of a suspension bridge. You'll see them not as static blocks of material, but as frozen battlegrounds of invisible force.
And to understand how we weaponize that force, we really have to start with the scale of the battlefield. In material science, we categorize residual stresses by how they balance themselves out.
Okay, so where do we start?
We start at the largest scale, what we call type I stresses, or macrostresses. These are forces that balance out over large microscopic distances, like across an entire engineering component.
So we're talking about forces that span a whole pane of glass or an entire metal beam from end to end.
Yeah, that's the exact scale. Type I stresses essentially originate from a massive physical misfit between different regions of the exact same object. The classic example of this is thermally toughened glass.
Oh, right, which is the glass in our car windows. The stuff that shatters into those tiny little harmless pieces instead of giant lethal shards.
The very same. And it shatters that way because of the massive internal forces trapped inside it during manufacturing. You basically heat the whole pane up until it's slightly soft and then blast the exterior surfaces with cold air.
So the outside cools really rapidly.
Exactly. Because the outside cools and solidifies first, it shrinks and locks into its final dimensions. But the deep interior is still hot. It's thermally expanded.
Oh, I see. So when the interior finally cools down a few minutes later and tries to shrink, the surface is already solid and won't let it.
Right, it's physically locked into a box that is now slightly too big for it, which creates this intense permanent tug of war. The interior desperately pulls inward, creating severe tension.
And because every action has an equal and opposite reaction, the interior pulls the outer surface inward. So the exterior shell is forced into a state of severe compression.
You got it. And compression is fantastic for glass.
Wait, really? I always just think of glass as super fragile.
Well, glass usually fails because tiny microscopic flaws on the surface get pulled apart by everyday tension, like when you lean on a window. But if the surface is already being heavily squeezed together by a massive built-in compression from the factory, those flaws physically can't open up.
Oh, wow. So the external force has to overcome all that factory compression before the glass even begins to feel any dangerous tension.
Exactly. It makes the glass incredibly strong against everyday impacts.
So it's kind of like a tightly coiled spring trapped inside a solid block of ice. As long as the ice holds, it's strong. But chip the ice deep enough and the spring violently explodes.
That is a great visual. But imagine the ice and the spring are the exact same material. The interior is mostly defect-free, so it can handle being under that immense spring force indefinitely. But the moment a crack from a rock or a dropped phone breaches that compressive outer armor,
the spring releases.
Yep, all that stored elastic energy just violently unloads at the speed of sound, and the material rips itself apart into that harmless mosaic pattern.
Okay, but glass is brittle. So, using temperature to freeze a stress state makes intuitive sense. How do we deliberately trap these forces inside metals without just bending them completely out of shape?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't just blast a red-hot cannon with cold air and expect it to hold military tolerances.
No, you definitely cannot. With ductile metals, we use a totally different mechanism called non-uniform plastic deformation. And this actually leads to one of the most brilliant mechanical engineering tricks in history. It's called autofrettage.
Ah, yes. I see you actually brought a physical blueprint of a high-pressure vessel today just for this exact point, complete with all your margin notes on the math.
Oh, the mechanics are just beautiful. I couldn't resist. So autofrettage is used for very thick metal cylinders. Think heavy gun barrels, cannon tubes, or high-pressure chemical reactors.
Okay, things that deal with extreme internal pressure.
Right. If you just machined a thick steel tube normally, the immense outward pressure from, say, firing a shell doesn't distribute evenly through the metal. The pressure concentrates almost entirely on the innermost wall.
So that inside layer takes all the explosive force, and the outer wall is just kind of along for the ride.
Which is incredibly inefficient. The inner layer stretches beyond its limit, microscopic cracks form, and the barrel fails catastrophically. So in the factory, before the barrel ever sees a battlefield, engineers do something kind of crazy. They intentionally overpressurize the inside to an extreme degree.
Wait, they basically try to blow it up in the factory.
Kind of. They pump hydraulic pressure in until the inner layers of the steel tube actually yield plastically. They force that inner ring of metal to permanently stretch outward.
But what about the outer layer of the barrel? Doesn't it stretch too?
It stretches. But because it's so thick, it remains fully elastic. It stretches outward to accommodate the bulging inner layer, but it acts like a giant stretched rubber band. It desperately wants to snap back to its original shape.
Oh, wow. So when the factory finally releases that massive hydraulic pressure,
the elastic outer layer violently squeezes back down, but it slams into the inner layer, which just got permanently stretched and is now physically too large.
So the outer layer is permanently trying to crush the inner layer. It's locked in a relentless compressive hug.
Exactly. You've just built a massive permanent compressive residual stress into the bore of the gun. Now, when it's fired in service, the explosive outward pressure has to fight through all that built-in compression first. You force the entire thickness of the barrel to share the load.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because the sources point out that this doesn't just happen at the macro scale. It's not just whole panes of glass or entire gun barrels. We need to zoom way, way in. What happens when the stress is between microscopic grains of the material itself?
This brings us to type 2 and type 3 residual stresses. Type 2 is the grain scale. These are forces balancing out over microscopic distances, usually across just a few adjacent grains in the material.
And type 3?
Type 3 is even smaller. We're talking atomic scale stresses balancing within a single grain, usually localized around tiny defects in the crystal lattice.
Let's focus on that type 2 grain-to-grain combat. The papers talk a lot about composite materials playing a huge role here.
Oh, composites are the ultimate playground for type 2 stresses. Imagine an aerospace metal matrix composite, like an aluminum matrix reinforced with tiny microscopic particles of a super hard ceramic, like silicon carbide.
Sounds like a great team. You get the crack-resisting flexibility of aluminum so it won't shatter, and the rigid strength of the ceramic to hold a load.
On paper, yeah, it's a brilliant team. But to get them to work together, you have to bond them at a really high temperature so the aluminum flows around the ceramic. The engineering nightmare is that they have vastly different coefficients of thermal expansion.
Meaning they shrink differently when they cool down. Mm.
Exactly. Aluminum wants to shrink significantly. The ceramic barely wants to shrink at all.
So it's like making a candle by pouring hot wax over a steel rod. As they cool, the wax tries to shrink a lot, but the steel rod refuses to budge. They're basically locked in a microscopic bad marriage.
The bad marriage analogy is spot on, but unlike soft yielding wax, aluminum is a high strength structural metal. So as it cools, it grips the ceramic particle and tries to crush it. And the rigid ceramic fiercely pushes back,
stretching the aluminum outward, generating these intense thermal microstresses everywhere.
At every single microscopic interface throughout the entire body of the airplane wing or turbine blade, the aluminum is left locked in a state of residual tension and the ceramic in residual compression.
But I have to push back here. If they are fighting at a microscopic level, everywhere, all at once, why doesn't the material just tear itself apart from the inside? I mean, if I'm flying at 30,000 feet, the last thing I want is the engine metal actively trying to rip itself off its own ceramic skeleton.
Well, the risk is very real. If those microstresses exceed the strength of the bond, tiny cracks form, propagate, and the component shears apart mid-flight. But when engineered correctly, The material finds an uneasy equilibrium governed by what we call the stress-free temperature.
Which I'm guessing is almost never room temperature.
Rarely ever. The stress-free temperature is the theoretical super elevated temperature you'd have to heat the composite back up to just to make the thermal misfits vanish and the fighting stop. But at standard room temperature, engineers actually use those type 2 stresses to their advantage.
Awful. If it's already fighting itself, how does that help?
It dictates how the material transfers load. Because the ceramic is already preloaded in compression and the metal in tension, when you apply an external pull to the wing, the rigid ceramic particles instantly take up a massive share of the structural burden.
Oh, so it effectively lets brittle, easily shattered ceramics and soft metals dynamically share a load they could never handle alone.
Yeah.
So we had these massive violent forces trapped in glass, in gun barrels, in microscopic metallic grains, but we can't see them. An airplane wing or a composite fiber just looks like a solid, quiet piece of material. So how do engineers actually measure a force they can't see?
Well, you actually can see the effects sometimes if you know where to look. Like, highly stressed glass bends polarized light, creating really colorful stress patterns. But to measure the hard mathematical numbers, engineers get incredibly creative. The toolkit is basically split into destructive and non-destructive methods.
Let's start with destruction. The papers highlight something called the hole drilling method. How does drilling a hole measure an invisible force?
It relies on the material's desire to relax. Imagine a thick metal plate, and the surface is under tight, invisible tension. Engineers take a highly sensitive cluster of sensors called a rosette and glue it directly to the surface.
A rosette. So the sensors are pointed in all different directions to catch movement from all angles.
Exactly. Then they use a precision drill to bore a tiny millimeter-sized hole right in the dead center of those sensors, physically removing a small core of the stressed material.
Wait, so it's like slashing a fully inflated tire to measure its pressure.
Mm-hmm.
The air rushes out, the tire collapses, and based on how violently it collapsed, you calculate what the pressure used to be.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize it. Because that tiny center core of metal was holding some of the tension, drilling it out makes the surrounding materials suddenly relax and deform to find a new equilibrium.
And the sensor cluster catches that microscopic relaxing.
Right. Computers read that distortion and back calculate the exact residual stress that must have been there before the hole existed.
But just like slashing the tire, you ruined it. I mean, you can't drill a hole in a critical submarine hull piece and just send it out into service.
Which is the fundamental flaw of destructive testing, and exactly why non-destructive diffraction techniques are so vital. If we can't drill into the part, we use atomic strain gauges. We abandon mechanical drilling and move to subatomic physics, specifically neutron diffraction.
Atomic strain gauges. Okay, so instead of a mechanical sensor, you're using the atoms themselves as the measuring tape.
You got it. Every crystalline metal is made of atoms arranged in neat, predictable geometric grids. We know exactly how far apart those atoms should be at rest. So we fire a beam of neutrons deep into the solid component.
And they bounce off the atoms?
They scatter. If the metal is under residual tension, the grid is stretched and the atoms are pulled slightly further apart than normal. If it's under compression, they're squished closer together. By measuring the microscopic shift in how the neutrons scatter, we calculate the exact distance between atoms and therefore the exact stress.
Wait, why neutrons? Why not just use X-rays? We use X-rays for literally everything else.
X-rays interact heavily with electrons, so they get absorbed almost immediately. An X-ray beam will just bounce off the very top surface. Great for surface coatings, but totally useless for looking deep inside a thick, solid component.
Ah. And neutrons don't do that.
Right. Neutrons have no electrical charge. They ghost right through the electron clouds and penetrate deep into thick materials, literally centimeters deep into solid steel. We can sweep a neutron beam through a massively thick pipeline and 3D map its internal stress without ever leaving a scratch.
That's amazing. And yet, reading through the sources, you clearly have a soft spot for some of the super niche sci-fi measurement methods that sit at the extreme edges of this field.
Oh, the extremes are where the real ingenuity shines. When standard methods fail, engineers get wild. Take Barkhausen emission. Steel is basically made of tiny magnetic domains. When you put it under immense physical stress, those domains are forced to change their orientations.
Okay, so the magnets physically move.
Yeah. And if you apply a sweeping magnetic field, you can attach a specialized coil and actually listen to the microscopic magnetic domains snapping into new alignments. The acoustic rate at which they snap gives you a highly accurate measure of the internal stress.
You are literally putting a stethoscope up to a solid block of steel and listening to its magnetic stress. That's insane.
Borderline magic, honestly. And then there's piezospectroscopy used for composites. You intentionally contaminate a single microscopic structural fiber with a trace amount of chromium.
Just one fiber?
Yep. When you shine a laser on that specific fiber under a microscope, the chromium fluoresces. It glows. But if that fiber is being heavily squeezed by residual compression from the surrounding metal matrix, the actual color of that glowing light shifts.
Wow. So you can map the crushing stress just by reading the subtle color changes of the light.
Exactly. Just by reading the light.
Okay. We need to move to the final piece of the puzzle. Because everything we've talked about so far involves external factors being applied to the material. We blasted glass with cold air, pumped hydraulic pressure into guns, forcefully bonded materials together. But what happens when the material mutates its own crystal structure from the inside out?
This brings us to the fascinating world of solid-state phase transformations. In certain metals, primarily steel, the internal crystal structure itself is not permanent. The geometric arrangement of the iron and carbon atoms literally rearranges depending on the temperature.
Like shape-shifting.
Yeah.
And there are two main ways the atoms accomplish this, right? Reconstructive and displacive. Break those down for me.
A reconstructive transformation is somewhat slow, polite, and orderly. The atoms unbind, diffuse around, and slowly build a completely new crystal lattice. It usually just causes a simple, uniform swelling or shrinking in all directions. But a displacive transformation is a violent, highly coordinated, military-style maneuver.
The sources mention steel turning into martensite or bainite here.
Which are simply different, highly strained geometric arrangements of those same atoms. During a displacive transformation, the atoms don't slowly diffuse. Millions of atoms simultaneously shear into a new rigid geometry in a fraction of a second. It involves a massive shear and a rapid volumetric expansion.
So it forces the material to dramatically expand and change shape in very specific geometric directions.
Yes.
So the metal isn't just passively cooling and shrinking. It's actively shape-shifting like a transformer, aggressively changing its atomic geometry while trapped inside a solid block.
Exactly. And this violent shape-shifting creates massive internal misfits. To really see how crazy this gets and how it manipulates stress, we have to look at a brilliant historical experiment by Jones and Albury.
Okay. Lay it on me.
They took a solid rod of steel, specifically an atomic arrangement called austenite, and put it into a mechanical testing rig. They clamped the ends completely tight so the rod physically could not change its length. Then they started rapidly cooling it down.
Okay, normally if you cool any metal down, it desperately wants to undergo thermal contraction. It wants to shrink, but it's trapped by the clamps. So an intense pulling tension builds up inside the rod.
Right. As the temperature drops, the metal is screaming to shrink, but the clamps hold it in place. The thermal contraction causes a massive, dangerous buildup of tensile stress. If this were normal steel, that stress would just keep rising steeper and steeper until it reached room temperature. You'd be left with an incredibly brittle component.
But they purposefully used a steel that undergoes one of those violent displacive phase transformations.
Exactly. Right as the pulling tension inside the rod is getting dangerously high, the temperature drops just enough that the steel hits its transformation point. It suddenly mutates from austenite into bainite.
And during that displacive transformation, it violently expands. The new geometric arrangement of the atoms physically takes up more space.
You got it. The atoms forcefully push outward, and that outward push completely counteracts the thermal contraction that was trying to shrink the rod.
Wait, really? Even though the metal as a whole is still getting colder?
Yes. The internal transformation overpowers the thermal shrinkage. The tensile stress stops building, plateaus, and literally reverses its direction, plunging back down to zero while the phase change happens.
That is incredible. The metal actively heals its own thermal stress by mutating its crystal structure midway through cooling.
It is a profound engineering mechanism. And what's amazing is researchers Davenport and Bain actually noticed this asymmetric deformation way back in 1930, decades before we had neutron beams to measure it. They realized the mutation physically pushes the metal around. The transformation strain literally acts as a form of internal plasticity, permanently and beneficially altering the residual stress landscape.
So what does this all mean? We started today by talking about a shattered window and a warped pipe. But looking at these exhaustive sources from Withers and Badacia, it becomes abundantly clear that residual stress isn't just a manufacturing defect.
Not at all. It is a hidden, meticulous architecture of force.
It's the invisible scaffolding that dictates the survival of absolutely everything around us. From bulletproof glass protecting a bank, to impossibly thick steel hulls on deep-sea submarines, all the way down to the microscopic ceramic fibers holding together a jet engine at 30,000 feet.
It really is.
It means the next time you accidentally drop your smartphone onto the concrete and you hold your breath and pick it up to find the screen practically bounced instead of breaking, or you fly through heavy turbulence and watch the wings flex, you should take a second. Thank those invisible, highly pressurized forces meticulously trapped inside that metal and glass by engineers who know exactly how to balance atomic tension.
It truly is the ghost in the machine. Residual stress is essentially a frozen-in memory of a materials manufacturing trauma.
That's a really poetic way to put it.
And that leads to a really profound lingering thought for you to explore. If we can currently freeze these forces in place, could we one day design smart materials?
What do you mean by smart materials?
Well, imagine a material that isn't just statically stressed. Instead of a pane of glass or a gun barrel having its compressive stress permanently baked in at the factory, imagine a material that dynamically shifts its internal atomic structure on command.
Oh, wow, like real-time adaptation.
Exactly. A material that actively senses a sudden impact or a changing thermal environment and instantly triggers a microscopic phase transformation.
Yeah.
Actively adjusting its own residual stress landscape to become perfectly compliant to absorb a blow or infinitely hard to deflect a projectile exactly when and where it's needed. We wouldn't just be trapping unseen forces anymore. We would be actively driving them.